Could we start with your first encounter with Lord Peric Lawrence? I mean, how did you first meet him?
Well, the first time I ever saw him to notice was when he was opposition spokesman for on India during the Churchill coalition. And of course in those days opposition was rather a formal affair. There had to be one, but it wasn't opposing very much. And on the whole, policies were fairly bipartisan. But Pethick was a fairly firm critic of Indian policies. And he used to make very terse and rather brief speeches, but very much to the point. And this was the more surprising because it emerged from this rather slightly doddering figure.
He was very crisp, wasn't he, somehow? I mean,
very
really
crisp
writing.
Indeed, yes. Mm. But you didn't expect this because he approached you looking about 10 years older than he actually was, even though he was 70. And these sharp remarks that came out were somewhat disconcerting. And anyway, there couldn't have been anything more clearly opposite than the Right Honourable Leopold Amory and Lord Pethick Lawrence, the one being very bouncy and self-confident, and the other being very thoughtful and rather severe in his intellectual purity. I was private secretary to them both, so I see this contrast rather plainly, but
they both
had great merits.
I see.
But they were very different kinds of people.
Yes, I see.
Well, then, of course, the day came when there was this extraordinary election and Churchill was thrown out. And Attlee swept in his Labour government. Well, now, to everybody's surprise, I think, the Lord Pethick Lawrence appeared as Secretary of State for India. And I approached him rather nervously, not quite sure what sort of reception I should get. But he proved to be perfectly charming. I got on with him like a house on fire. You had to be very careful because he gave appearance of not understanding a word of what you were saying and being rather distrained somewhere else. But you would find that you suddenly got a sharp inquiry as to what it was you meant.
You mean he would sit and listen, would he?
Listen to what you said very carefully. Mm. And you would wonder, rather, whether he was really taking it in, but there wasn't any trouble of that sort at all. And, of course, he had absolutely first-class mental equipment. Yeah. I don't know, I think he was a Smith's Prizeman or something in Cambridge in Maine.
Oh, yeah, he was a very intelligent man.
He was a perfectly intelligent man. I suppose our main difficulty was that he had some of these, what I call prejudices about British rule in India. He thought it was all wrong. He thought that it was an exploitation. And he thought that... he didn't think that that it was bad on its merits, but it was bad in principle.
Yeah.
In this he was just the same as all the rest of the Labour people. They all started from the premise that the whole thing was bad and should be got rid of. this wasn't anything very startling because, after all, we'd been trying to build up to a Dominion status, as it was called in those days, ever since 1919, and we'd got quite a long way with it. And we had the 1935 Act, which provided for Federation of all India, and we got provincial autonomy with Indian ministers and prime ministers in all provinces.
And we hadn't been able to get the Jolly Federation going because of the tension between the Muslims and the Hindus. And so when the war came, that had not been achieved. And the thing was unresolved. And during the war, there had been all sorts of pressures on the government about India, from the Americans and from Chiang Kai-shek. And all the people who said, look at China, how the great resistance to the Japanese in China is based on freedom of the Chinese, yeah, nationalist movement. And you must liberate these Indian nationalists and harness them to the war effort, you know. And the result of all this in the end was that Churchill very reluctantly agreed to the Cripps Mission in 1942. And in effect, the Cripps Mission said, Cripps Mission Declaration said, that we would set up a constituent assembly after the war, that it would be open to the Indian government thus created to secede from the empire if it wished to, but that none of this could start until the war was over. In the meantime, please join a combined
war effort,
government of all parties, yes, at the centre, and let us wage the war. Well, it's a long story, the Cripps Mission, but it failed, mainly because Gandhi was against it. And Gandhi at that time clearly thought the Japanese were going to win, as did most other people in India.
Of course, that's just before Singapore, isn't it? The fall of Singapore, really.
Well, it was after Singapore. Oh, no, just before Singapore.
Yes. Anyway, we're at pretty low ebb, aren't we, at that time?
Anyway, the Japanese Navy was marauding about off Ceylon, and we were at a very low ebb indeed. I think it was after Singapore. We might have to look that up.
Not to worry about it.
But anyway, the general situation was such that they were going to put their shirt on the British winning. So, when the Labour government came in, they had on the table, so to speak, this Cripps Mission Declaration. And this was their charter, they said. The first thing they said was that they intended to pursue the undertakings that contained in the Cripps Mission, even though it hadn't been accepted at the time, and they were going to set up a constituent assembly and all the rest of it. And then, of course, the main problem was how to get this thing set up when the Muslims were demanding Pakistan and refusing to come.
Yeah.
Well, Pethick approached all this with a good deal of caution, I think. He saw the difficulties, being very intelligent. But he was under a good deal of pressure, really, from Attlee and Cripps, and I think it would be fair to say that the Cripps Mission, the Cabinet Mission, was a product of Attlee and Cripps rather than Pethick. Pethick played a really important part in setting it up and framing a directive for it and all this sort of thing.
His status, just to interrupt you a moment, his status in the cabinet is presumably not terribly high because he's so old, first of all, and as you say, it was rather surprising.
Well, he wasn't in the sort of Attlee. Attlee had a sort of inner cabinet of six,
yes,
he wasn't in there. I mean, there was Cripps and Bebin and
one
or two other people.
Yes, yes. And of course, as you say, it was rather surprising that he, you know, in a sense, got the office in the first place, in view of his age, I suppose.
He was very surprised.
Was he really?
Oh, yes, he said.
Yeah.
Oh, I never thought of getting this job. He said,
really?
I had a job in the Treasury. That's what interested him, really. It was
finance.
Yes.
So I interrupted you, I'm sorry.
Well, I can't remember an awful lot about the period between his arrival in the office and the cabinet mission. It was only about 6 months, I think. We had a hectic time with cabinet committees meeting the whole time, framing this thing.
Could you just remind me what your position was before you started serving Lord Pethick Lawrence? You were really in the same...
Well, position. I was private secretary to the Secretary of State, and I've been private secretary to Amory for about 3 years or four. Yeah.
So really, you hold the continuous...
And I just went on.
Yes, I see. So you really
And then I was private secretary to Pethick, and I went out to India with him. And when I came back, I went on doing the constitutional work... the Independence Act and all that, and so I ceased to be private secretary.
Yes, I see.
Although I still had a good deal to do with him, because this was the main thing that was going on in the office.
So how did Amory and Pethick Lawrence compare as people to work for, really? I presume their opinions are very different, but personalities too. And you've got a marvellous comparison between the two, if you're doing the same job under both.
Well... Of course, their attitudes were very different. I mean, Amory thought that Gandhi was a mischievous old man, which is what a lot of other people think too, and that his main concern was to Mr. Gandhi should have a prominent place in the world, which indeed he achieved. And he certainly never thought that. Amory didn't think anything much of the idea of getting the Congress to support the war effort. He believed that if you had them in, they would just use it to lever more out of you, and very likely would change sides at the appropriate moment. Which I think was probably a more realistic judgment than that of the Labour Party.
But was he going along quite happily by the Second World War with this line of continuity of 1919 that you mentioned? I mean, in a sense, it doesn't fit with his earlier ideals, does it? But
Pethick?
No, I'm talking about Amory now. Amory. I mean, ideally, presumably, he would have favoured the continuance of the British Raj in India.
Amory was a strong Dominion man, you see.
Mm.
And he was very much concerned with the setting up of South Africa.
Mm.
And he was always for giving people
a devolution,
full degree of independence within the Commonwealth.
I see.
He was a Commonwealth man.
Yes,
well, it was called the Empire in those days.
Yes.
Right? Commonwealth emerged a bit later.
So the
but his great hope was that you would get a unified India with a federal constitution on the lines of the 1935 Act, that it would in fact stay within the Empire, stay with the Commonwealth, and that this could in time with patience be achieved. And above all, you mustn't have a division. Well, the Labour people believed that you mustn't have a division too, but they came to have it.
So it's not a tremendous jolt of policy, particularly the succession of Pethick Lawrence to Amory. There's a certain amount of continuity.
No, it's a change of attitude, really, and of conviction that you must... the Labour government was committed, really, to setting up a constituent assembly and having Indian Home Rule, Indian independence. PDQ. And... in the end, you see, they didn't stop at anything. I mean, they said, oh, well, if it can only be done on the basis of partition, we must have partition.
Yes.
Whereas at all costs, we must do this. And the most conservatives were against partition.
So Amory would have taken a different position
on that.
I think
Amory would have held out against partition, for all probability. But, of course, it's all these things. These people aren't individuals, you see. They're all members of governments,
and
if you were in a government with Churchill at the top, what you could do about India was rather limited.
Fair enough, yes. But what about to work for, so to speak, if you compare the two men, is that easy to do for you? I mean, how do they compare vis-à-vis you as personal private secretary?
Well, Amory would do much more for himself. I mean, he fancied himself as a constitutionalist, and he would write out his own speeches, and very often if there was some document that was going to be published, a statement, as it was called in those days, I mean, a draft would appear in Mr. Amory's box, and then you would have to try and get this into shape. But Pethick would always work on the other hand. I mean, he would expect the office to produce a draft, and he would either alter it or rewrite it, or whatever he felt like.
That's interesting. I mean,
you see, he hadn't the bounding energy that Amory had. Amory was ceaselessly active. But he wasn't any worse for that, because he was a very shrewd critic of anything that was put up to him.
Yes.
Well, now, I don't know if there's much more to say about that part of the time.
Do move forward.
Then we come to the cabinet mission. And this was really quite a do, because it was three cabinet ministers, Pethick Lawrence, Cripps, and A.V. Alexander, extraordinary to relate, who knew nothing about it. That was put in by Attlee as a sort of make-weight, I think, sort of a balancing factor, because he knew that Pethick Lawrence and Cripps would probably come to deadlock, and he wanted to have a third independent brain working in the thing. And these gentlemen were to team up with the Viceroy and to negotiate the basis for setting up a constituent assembly. Well, we set off. I went. They all took their private secretaries, so I went as Pethick's private secretary. But I was also sort of secretary to the thing, kept all the records. Then we had the deputy secretary of the India Office, a man called Croft, came as principal advisor. And of course, flocks of other people came and pressed me in. And so we had a
nice little caravan.
Political advisor for dealing with princes and this sort of thing, you see. And we had an enormous aeroplane. And the First Lord of the Admiralty insisted on going in his own airplane, so we didn't bother about him. And Cripps said he was very tired and must have a rest. So it was arranged that we should go to Tunis. And we stopped in Tunis for two nights, I think it was. Maybe three anyway. It was quite a little pause there was in Tunis. This was Pethick and Cripps. And it's really all terribly incongruous, because the Bay of Tunis's summer palace was made available. And this was a sort of Muslim, something out of Arabian Nights, a beautiful marble courtyard with buildings around it on one floor and fountains playing, one thing there. And you sat on poofs on the floor. Pethick was very pleased, because he was put in Bay's principal apartment, and Tabard Cripps was put in the Zunada. He was talking away about this.
He had a good sense of humour, actually, didn't he?
Yeah, a great sense of humour. Anyway, it was all a bit embarrassing because of the French laid on this terrific thing, you see, and Tunisian butlers and people stood around holding bottles of wine, and of course they wouldn't go down and drink any wine, they were all teetotal. So poor old George Blaker and I had to say that we were graciously pleased to have some of the wine. Which of course is the very best French wine. And then we went to dinner with the French Resident General, who was some very pro-British general who had been with us in the Middle East, I think, in the war. And that was quite an occasion. And the French were all very pro-British, all the ones out there were. bit unusual. And then we took off and we went to Cyprus and stayed a night there, I think.
Was it well a long journey anyway? It was a nice travel long
journey. We came down in Cyprus for lunch, and then we went to Baghdad and spent the night, and they spent the night in the embassy. We all spent the night in great discomfort somewhere else. And then I think we went from Baghdad to Lehar there, as I remember. Nothing else terribly amusing happened during the journey. When we got to Delhi, we were all put up we had a house. We stayed in, I think we stayed two nights in the Viceroy's house or something, while we were conferring with the Viceroy. The governors from all provinces in India came, conferred with them, one thing or another. And then we had a house in the grounds of the Viceroy's house, which belonged to the military secretary. And this contained three ministers and all their private secretaries, and William Croft. And we really had a sort of house party in this place. And all meals were taken in common. And there was a good deal of banter. And A.D. Alexander, seeing that Cripps was very thick with all the Congress leaders, very shrewdly made it his business to chum up with Jinnah. So he used to go off to Muslim parties in the evening. Cripps was always going on, nodding at the Congress people. Bethick stayed at home, made a rule that he would not go out in the evening and accept any evening invitations. This was very sensible because there he was, 72, boiling heat.
Yeah.
Everybody said before he went out and before Bethick would come back in his coffin. But in fact, Bethick came back not fitter than any of the others. The others were all ill and he was the only one who wasn't ill. But he took no alcohol, he had very little meat, and went to no parties.
To conserve his energies, really.
To conserve his energies for the main business. And this presented a little problem because there wasn't anything much for him to do in the evenings. But it was then discovered that he was a very good billiards player.
Oh, yeah.
So we played billiards with him. And this was very great fun.
He was a very keen billiards player.
Well, of course, he was far better than any of us, but however, we had some fun. And this was the principal form of entertainment. It was a little flat tie for private secretaries who might otherwise gone on the dials, but we stayed in billiards with him usually.
Did he like to win, actually? I mean, in billiards?
Oh, I think so, yes.
And what was his attitude to the game? Was he very competitive?
He wasn't aggressively anxious to win, but he was well satisfied to win. Slightly patronising, you know. I mean, well, justifiably so, because he was a Cambridge Blue or something in his day, and on the hill. Regarded us as novices, I think, quite rightly.
So he could absolutely concentrate on the game, could he, despite all these things going on? He could relax completely?
Oh, he could relax and play billiards after dinner, yes, with anybody.
Yeah.
Well, cabinet missions consisted really of endless meetings with Indian leaders. And these were held in the morning and sometimes in the afternoon as well. And it was a dreary story because, of course, they were hopes with loggerheads.
The Indians among themselves, you mean? Indians and
Well, the Indian, the main Indian division, of course, was between Jinnah and the Muslim League and the Congress.
Mm.
And they were poles apart because the Congress wanted to have a a constituent assembly based on one man, one vote, and a strong federal centre, which meant Hindu rule for India, and the Muslims wanted to have the opposite, namely either no federation at all, i.e. Pakistan, separate federation for Muslim states, or a very weak centre, just foreign affairs and defence, and everything else would be developed elsewhere. Mm. The cabinet mission was really resolved itself into an attempt to build something which was between these two things, and had a third tier, you see. And the idea was you would have foreign affairs and defence and communications, perhaps, as central subjects, and then you would have what were called group governments. Mm. Groups of states could form a sort of sub-federation for more subjects. And this was really aimed at realising the substance of Pakistan without destroying the unity of India for defence and foreign affairs. And the Congress disliked this because they said the central government would be too weak and unable to cope with the economic and social problems of India. And the Muslim League didn't like it because they didn't want any central government at all. And above all, they didn't want the Hindus to have control of the army. So in the end, the thing ground to a halt. It went on for 3 months. In the course of this, we had two sorties. One was to Kashmir, where we went for Easter. And this was just a spree, really. It was arranged with the Maharaja of Kashmir. He kindly entertained the cabinet mission and the viceroy, which of course he had little option but to do, but could well afford to do. And so we went there, and we had a very nice 3 days. Bethick enjoyed it, I think, very much, and did him a lot of good. Mm. He seemed to respond to attitude, liked high places. Then we went in the aeroplane. My senior colleague said that the higher your gentleman goes, the fairer his head becomes. Anyway, he enjoyed himself in Kashmir. I don't know what he did all the time. I went fishing. Stafford Cripps was a great fisherman, so that was very popular. He had fishing parties. Bethick, I suppose, must just have paddled about. Anyway, we went to all the sort of leading sites in Srinagar. We lived in a Maharaja's guest house. Now, there was a curious incident occurred while we were in Kashmir, because Bethick said to me that there was a lady who was coming to see him. So I said, is this an Indian lady? So he said, no, she's an English lady and she lives out here. So I was rather bashful about this. So I said, pretty extraordinary or something. Anyway, at the appointed hour, there appeared a most extraordinary figure, dressed in saffron robes. I can't remember her name, but this was some English lady from his feminist past, who had become a Buddhist. And she resided, I suppose, in some institution or something in the Kashmir Mountains. Very nice, too. Anyway, she appeared and they had a heart to heart and she went away again. This was just a sort of reunion. But he was rather bashful about this. He said, of course you know, I think this was the occasion, he said, of course you know, I'm really a vintage crank. So I understand cranks.
Seems.
And I think this was true in a way.
He could laugh at himself a bit,
though. Oh, yes,
he didn't take himself too seriously.
To some extent, he laughed at his past, I think.
That's interesting. Because he was, of course, involved with Indian nationalism very early on, in the 1920s, wasn't he? I mean, he was writing articles for newspapers.
Oh, I think so, yes. He's always been, always in this. Well, the other sortie was to Simla. We had the thing got so difficult and was so hot in Delhi and everybody was so bad-tempered. And Gandhi was being so difficult. But it was decided to go to Simla and invite the more sensible Congress leaders, namely Nehru and Patel, and Jinnah and two of his chaps. And one or two other people representing minorities, come to Simla for a conference to see whether a document could be agreed on the basis of this idea of having group governments. So we had, I think, 10 days in Simla. And it was very intensive. So Perik didn't turn a hair. It's 7,000 feet at Simla. And not everybody can shoot up out of the heat and sit down at 7,000 feet without noticing it. But the old boy didn't turn a hair. Cripps was ill, which was very embarrassing and awkward.
Still, I didn't want to waste your time talking about these.
Well, I used to know a lot about the Medical Research Council, of course, but that was in the Hemsworth days.
Yes.
And Hemsworth was absolutely against this Rothschild bargain.
Was he really? It's clearly a mess, I think. But one thing I want to ask you about Perik, when he went off to India, was he very apprehensive about whether he could cope, so to speak, whether he could take it? Was he nervous?
I think he was a bit, yes. Yes, I think he was apprehensive his health would break down. And not unreasonably. It was a very bold thing, really, to take it on.
How did he live, really? I mean, did he get up early in the morning and take exercise? I mean, how did he keep himself in shape, so to speak, apart from abstaining from parties that you mentioned?
What do you mean, in India?
Yes. He's very regular in his habits, wasn't he? Very rigid in that way.
I don't think he went out before breakfast, but he did. But he went for a walk in the nice regal grounds. I think he did, probably. It was the only time of day you could do it, just before breakfast.
But you see, his secretaries say that he would only do certain things at certain times and would get quite irritable, you know, if his routine was disrupted.
He started a little game at luncheon in this house we had, which was guessing the temperature. And everybody had to put down their bet as to what the temperature was today. And he always won. And I couldn't make out how he did this. So one day I said to him, how on earth do you manage to get it right every time? So he said, you see, I walk back from the Viceroy's house to lunch. Then I come through that tunnel. There was a long tunnel under a wing of the palace. And when I'm in there, I say to myself, oh, what's the temperature here in the shade?
And he'd enjoy being right, I suppose.
Oh, yes, he'd really enjoy being right in Cripps as well.
How did they get on, actually, those two?
Well, fairly well. I think he rather resented Cripps's tendency to dominate the proceedings and I think he was right the whole time. But on the whole, he was fairly patient under this. And quite often he would upset Cripps's proposals and, you know, just to push them aside and get the other two to agree on something else. And Cripps didn't have his own way the whole time, by any means. But Cripps, of course, was a staggering person. I mean, the flow of ideas and new thoughts that came out of Cripps was quite astonishing.
You mean sort of the expedients for bringing two sides together?
Yes, I see, I suppose. I think he thought up this idea of having groups of provinces. He elaborated this in all the various drafts. And these things shot out of him at extraordinary speed. And on the whole, marvellously high standard he produced.
Was he the constitutional expert, so to speak, or did you have, was there a civil servant who did that? I mean, who had experience of framing?
Croft, of course, had clear experience, and I had been with Cripps' mission, so I knew a good deal about it.
I see, yes.
And then, of course, there were the Viceroy's people, who played a quite considerable part in the thing. I mean, there was the Reforms Commissioner, as he was called, who was responsible for all constitutional questions. He was an Indian. He was a very able chap.
Did you feel, actually, when Pedic Lawrence was in the company of Indians, whether Muslim or Hindu, that he had a sort of affinity with them? Because, of course, his religion was partly...
Well, he thought he had a great affinity with Gandhi because they'd both been in jail. And this would be a great bond of union between him and Gandhi. And I think he bowled this out at the first interview with Gandhi, and it didn't go off quite so well as he'd hoped. Gandhi, I think, simply said, well, you haven't been in an Indian jail.
I see, yes, yeah, so that card was played or finished, I see, yes, interesting. Because, of course, Gandhi was rather influenced by the woman suffrage campaign. I mean, he did take account of the way in which the suffragettes behaved in his own...
Right, I say, Gandhi got quite a lot of ideas from it.
Hmm.
I think it's quite possible.
Yes, yes. So it was a good card.
Well, I think there was this sort of fellow feeling between them, in that they were both exponents of non-violent resistance in different arenas. There probably was something in this. And he got on well with Gandhi. Of course, I think a thing he hadn't realized, which influenced this, was that the Indians have great respect for people. I mean, as in China, age is synonymous with wisdom. And the older you are, the more respect and...
That's very interesting, yes. That presumably wasn't in Attlee's mind, I mean...
No, he didn't know this before he got there. But it was quite evident in the sort of attitude of the journalists and people to him. He derived respect from the fact that he was white-haired and aged. Obviously, he
and looked older than
looked
he
older
was.
Than he was. Yeah.
That's very interesting. But he does, in his personal life, share some of the sort of religious attitudes that were current among Hindus. And I wondered whether you felt that, in a sense, he'd come home, so to speak, by coming to India.
No, I don't think I did feel that. But of course, he was a lot more at one with them than any conservative politician would be.
Yes.
I suppose partly because suffragism and all that was a non-violent movement, so it was supposed to be, wasn't it?
Yes, mind you, he was in the militant part of it, but still, it was a sort of resistance to government tyranny movement. At least that's how it saw itself. Yes. What about Alexander? I mean, what sort of, does he actually play the reconciling role that Attlee designed for him in the trio?
Yes, to some extent. He got on very well with Wavell, which was a good thing, because the Wavell was not at all at one with Cripps and Pethick. I mean, great soldiers don't take very kindly to the idea of non-violence somehow.
No.
And there's a rather testy passage in Wavell's diaries about Bethick getting up to offer Gandhi a glass of water at one of the meetings. I'd forgotten about this, but it's obviously an idea out of the old general field marshal very much. Bethick left the chaprasi to do this. Gandhi wanted a glass of water. But of course that's a sort of ruling race idea, really. But,
yes.
It's following Bethick.
Yes.
Well, now, I don't know that I've got any more to tell you.
That's funny. You did, in a sense, I interrupted you when you were talking about Simla. When they got into close consultation for that 10 days, were you actually present at these discussions, or were you... I mean, what's your role in relation to these rather close...
No, I sat in on all the meetings.
Did you really?
All the formal meetings. I mean, there were occasions when Cripps or somebody would talk with Nehru sort of informally and try and win them round and all that sort of thing. But all formal meetings were where the whole cabinet mission was present. I was there.
And you took minutes, and, did you?
I took minutes, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
These are all going to be published quite soon.
Are they really?
Well, there's a unit... at the Inter Office Library, which belongs to the Foreign Office now, a historical unit, which is producing volumes on volumes of documents. And they did one on the Cripps mission about 4 years ago, and they've done another one on the next stage, I believe, is published. And they told me the other day that the cabinet mission one is now in the press.
I see.
So if you really want to go into the cabinet mission, you could get hold of that when it comes out. It costs you about £10, I think.
I think you probably get
Oxford University to pay for that.
Yes. I don't know how free you are to talk about what actually went on in these meetings. I mean, I was going to ask you quite what role Bethick tended to play in these close discussions. I mean, how dominant he was, what sort of style of argument he tended to adopt and that sort of thing.
He played quite a considerable part. I suppose it would be fair to say that Cripps played the leading role in putting forward ideas. But Bethick was very good at pinning people down, which was not an easy thing to do with Hindus. Almost everything they say is capable of three interpretations, or certainly two. And Bethick was very swift to see this. Cripps was usually quite content to accept a fair-sounding phrase.
Of course, you'd notice this more than anybody as compiler of the minutes.
Well, yes, but you wouldn't say that Bethick had a suspicious mind, but he was a very accurate mind. And he wouldn't take a fair remark that sounded all right. It could mean three different things when you couldn't go into it. So from that point of view, he was a very valuable part of the discussion. But he would sit there with his piercing blue eye and say, well, do you mean so-and-so, or do you mean this? And this was very necessary.
Was he the sort of clearest headed of the team?
I should think he was, yes.
Yes, yes. That sort of precise mathematical...
Wavell, you know, was no fool. Wavell had a very good head.
So he helps, in a sense, to clarify the progress made and sort of to make concrete the discussions.
Really. Well, yes, to solidify the results, so to speak. I mean, without Bethick being there, I think we should have been in terrible chaos, because you have these meetings and people say things, and of course every time with the Hindus, there's a dispute afterwards as to what they've said or what it means. And anything you say will probably be interpreted in some way you never dreamt of.
Did he get irritated, actually, by that? Or, I mean, was he patient and calm, or did he actually lose his temper?
He was patient and calm most of the time. He got irritated with Jinnah. You went on being very obstructive. But I think by the end of it, he was irritated with a lot. I mean, when we were coming away, more or less, he said to me, I'm very disappointed in Gandhi. He's not as great a man as I thought he was. So that I think he ended up very much disillusioned.
Is that the impression Vera Brisson gives, actually? One of the few sort of things one does get out of her account is that it was a great disappointment.
I'm sure it was, you see, and this, to him, was the sort of supreme effort of his life. And when it was over, he really didn't feel like going on being Secretary of State for India. He wanted to retire, which he did. But he retired in a state of disillusion about India, I think.
Because another reason why, again, relying on Vera Brisson, he didn't like going to India was because he was separated from Lady Pettit Lawrence. I mean, he didn't expect to be there for so long, and he didn't like being separated from her anyway. And they wrote to each other sort of a lot of letters while they were separated. I mean, did you get any sort of impression of that sort of...
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, I think he wrote to her every day.
Yes.
And, yes, I think I very much had the impression that he and Lady P.L. were a combined team the whole time, and that good deal of what went on in the office was communicated to Lady P.L. and it shouldn't have been. But she was quite discreet on the whole. And I never knew really quite how much of what Pettit said was with Lady Pettit Lawrence and how much was him.
Yes. Interesting. Yes, you think she actually did provide ideas?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Interesting. Because they're a very odd team, but they were a team throughout their lives, those two. They're a very interesting pair, actually, I think. But can I ask you a bit about what he's like simply to be secretary for? I mean, can you, not necessarily just while you're on the mission, but generally, I mean, what's he like to work for with paperwork and sort of doing a private secretary?
Oh, quite good. Quite good. He disposed of what you gave him all right, you see. I mean, the principal difficulty you have with ministers is when you give them a lot of work to do and they don't finish it.
Yes. Yeah. So he was businesslike.
But he never had that trouble with Pethick. He always got through it. He would grumble about the amount of it, that sort of thing. But I think he quite often sat up until 2 a.m. doing it. But he was very conscientious. And I don't think he failed to understand what he was doing at all.
And he could delegate, could he?
Yes, I think so. He liked to write his personal letters himself, rather. But he would delegate part of the general business. He didn't try to do it himself. I mean, we had a terrible... This is irrelevant. Is your machine on?
Yeah, shall I switch it off?
No. Go switch it off, will you?
Yes, Farmy.
We don't think I have any more to tell you, really.
That's really very, very, very helpful. See, one thing that his secretary said was that he was very pernickety. I mean, very fussy, really, about how things should be done.
It was a bit fussy.
Was very irritated with interruptions, for instance, and wouldn't want the phone to be pushed. To be put through to him while he was doing certain things, you know. I mean, he's very, I suppose, businesslike in a sense.
Yes, I don't remember this.
But, you know, when he was answering...
He was a bit fussy. He could be put out to anything unexpected happening.
Hmm.
And sometimes a little unreasonably, I remember... some occasion when he suddenly came back from lunch at 1:45 or something, and of course I was out. Only my boyfriend was there, and he'd got something rather important he wanted to do, which he'd come back to do early, and he wanted to ask me about it. And then he got rather hit up because I wasn't there, but I mean, it couldn't be helped. Yes, I think he did get a bit fussed with small things.
I'll tell you one incident, actually.
It's a very funny thing. Happened on the way back. Because this great airplane and all these people in it came down at Augusta, the tower of Sicily, which was a sort of wartime RAF base, you see. And I think we spent the night at Augusta, as far as I remember. Anyway, the more enterprising young people went out and nosed around in Augusta, where they found the market with masses of apricots on sale, so everybody loaded up. Large basket of apricots. And when we got on the plane, the only person who hadn't got any apricots was Paul Pethick, you see. And Stafford Cripps discovered that poor Pethick had absolute passion for apricots and didn't know about this, and sort of gotten on to the idea. So as a last friendly gesture from the Caribbean Mission staff, we all contributed to a basket of apricots for Pethick. Somewhat unwillingly in some cases, I think.
So did he start eating them straight away?
Or? I don't think so, no. What happened to Emily then?
I mean, another thing about him is that he has got very fixed attitudes to diet, as far as I can see. I mean, for breakfast he always had a large glass or glass and a half of barley water and a toast with jam, and always ate the jam out of the pot as well, having eaten the toast. Now, I mean, I don't know whether you noticed
these things. No, I didn't know these strange things.
I mean,
I should imagine he was a bit what some people would call a faddist about food.
Yeah, oh, very much so, yes.
He had a thing about having baths, too. I mean, he said to me once, shouldn't have hot baths. It's bad for you, remove the natural oils. And I thought this sounded rather...
Because he'd had cold baths at Eton, I suppose.
Yes, I know. He used to have cold baths in India.
And yet, he combines these...
When it was very hot, he would get into a lukewarm bath. It's one of the things he used to do in Delhi. I don't know how much all this sort of food faddism was a thing of his own, how much it was Emmeline's. Might well have been hers.
I mean, clearly he would move among circles where there would be a lot of vegetarians around. And as you say, in India he didn't eat much meat. But that may have been...
I don't think he was a vegetarian, was he?
No, I mean he...
Cripps was a vegetarian, but that was for medical reasons.
What a pair to go out with. I mean, an incredible pair they were.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the work for... How did you sort of live in this house?
Well, very funny day in the house when the First Lord, who was a bit of a bull in China shop really compared to the others, he said he couldn't deal with all this ridiculous Indian food we were having. He must have a lunch consisting of steak and kidney pie and apple tart. So this was duly ordered, and we had steak and kidney pie and apple tart. Everybody was absolutely perspiring. Pethick is much amused by this.
But Pethick quite happily settled down to Indian food, did he?
Well, it wasn't Indian food, but it was rather sort of a bit Indian food, and a lot of curries and things. Yes,
because one thing is...
Sweet of Indian cooks, people looked after us.
Yes.
They did European food, but there was a bit sort of curry-fied.
I see, yeah. One thing his nieces told me was that he has this rather, in a sense, he's rather childlike man. I mean, loves things that children like as we said, winning games or eating the sort of food that children eat, or a sort of rather puckish sense of humour somehow.
Mm.
And, you know, they say, I'm not even
I think it's quite possible, but I don't think these characteristics compared very much in his visual life.
And they say, you see, he never really had a proper childhood because he was very much younger than his brother and sister, I think. Never really had a proper childhood. But he's clearly a much more human character.
Was sent out to
Yes.
try and do on the basis that... he was the last viceroy, and they'd better get together and arrange something.
So you sort of put a pistol at their heads,
in a sense? In a sense, yes, and this led to the partition of India.
Yes, yes, yes. Very nice, thank you very much.